that you love. This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, kpft.org online. Thank you. That music in a hurry. Welcome to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm Mike Koenig. I'm here with Egberto Willis on the engineering console. We are taking phone calls tonight. It is open forum. The phone number is 713-526-KPFT. The Real Spring fundraiser is now over. Now we are on the soft fundraiser. So if you feel like helping to support this show and KPFT, you can go to the website, kpft.org, or you can call during the daytime, and that number is 713-526-4000, not to be confused with our call-in number tonight. If you want to participate on the show, 713-526-5738, open forum. I have some stuff I'm going to throw out, but you are not required to talk about them. Okay. I guess the big news that's carried over from the weekend is the big biker brawl in Waco. You know, with all the media attention, there is still one question I have not heard answered. Which were the good bikers with guns, and which were the bad bikers with guns? Because we all know that the only answer to a bad biker with a gun is a good biker with a gun. So I am waiting for the media to sort that out for me. Okay, another thing that periodically pops up on my radar screen. You know, we talk occasionally about conservative memes that seem to take over a conversation. So, for example, entitlements is a term that Republicans came up with to make the social safety net seem like a bad thing. Egberto, there are some other terms. I'm going to have to make a list. I'm actually working on compiling a list. What are some other terms that Republicans and conservatives have come up with to make a good thing sound?
Death tax is one of them.
Death tax for inheritance tax.
We also have the clear skies for polluting the air.
The clear sky pollution law.
They go over and over with these.
Well, right to life. You know that right to life was something they came up with because originally the discussion was framed as pro-abortion, anti-abortion.
Right.
And they didn't want to be anti. They did focus groups. Anti was a bad thing. So they had to come up with pro-something. So they came up with pro-choice. So then when they came up with pro-choice, the pro-abortion forces realized they can't be pro-abortion because that was – the conversation was turning bad, so they became pro-choice.
Pro-life.
No, you had pro-abortion,
so
anti-abortion.
The conservatives became pro-life.
The conservatives became pro-life, and the liberals became pro-choice.
Right. Yes.
But you see, everyone tries to reframe. And I guess one of the things that brought that up to mind today, I have found, and I don't know if anyone else is having this problem, have you ever found that when you ask somebody a direct question that pretty much only has three possibilities, yes, no, or maybe something like sort of. Yes, kind of, no, kind of. Okay, so that's three possible answers. I'm a big fan of the yes, no question, and then getting yes or no, as an answer. I was on the phone trying to make reservations. One of the reasons I got here a little bit late today was because I was really, really trying to get through a reservation with United for my wife and my mother-in-law. And a question came up about doing it directly with United with a United card versus doing it with a travel agent with a United card, and how does the miles work, you know? Because with United, if you use a United card making a United reservation, you get twice the miles for the purchase price. So the question was, if we bought a United ticket through a travel agent, is that the same as buying it from United, or is that the same as essentially buying it from Walmart? In other words, you get one mile per dollar as if it's just any other vendor. So we called up United. You know, I think I had to ask the question at least, I lost count, but it was at least five times. If we do this, yes or no. If we do that, yes or no. And we kept getting all these extraneous words in an answer, and none of them were yes or no. And I have found this to be a very common problem. I mean, I don't want to single out United, except that's the one that happened today. But people, maybe it started with politicians, you know, and they've just polluted the culture. But it's really hard to ask a yes or no question. You know, in sales training, I'll let you talk in a moment. I just got to say, in sales training, they tell you there are two kinds of questions to ask customers if you're trying to elicit information in order to help them make choices. You can ask an open question or a closed question. An open question is, what would you like to see in this washing machine in terms of features? That's an open question. So they have to come up with stuff. A closed question would be, do you want to buy a front loader? And that's because people are asking me about washing machines over the last couple of days. But do you want to buy a front loader? That's a closed question. That's a yes or a no. Or you might get a maybe. They're open to the possibility. Can't get yes or no answers to anything. It's like every question is an open question. Your turn.
I mean, it's simple. They just don't know. And they can't tell you that they just don't know.
A good answer is, I don't know.
You won't hear that. And even if you talk to many people, you don't hear that. I don't know. And the other problem is, in as much as you thought you got an answer, I would suggest when you get answers like that, you get a name, number, and a signature.
Oh, totally. I totally agree with that. Because, you know, it's like even the IRS statistically, the IRS will help you fill out your tax return. They'll go through the thing with you. They'll tell you. They'll explain it to you. But 50% of the time, their information is wrong. That's a statistical fact, or at least it was a few years ago. 50% of the time, when the IRS answers a question for you, it's likely to be incorrect. But here's the catch. It's still your responsibility. It doesn't matter if you get a name and an employee ID, and you can get them to play back the recording, because, you know, this call may be recorded for customer service purposes. Doesn't matter. It's still your fault. So we have a real problem. We're in a computer age where computers are increasingly taking over many things. The one thing I want computers to take over is the responsibility for yes or no answers. Can we run a program for that? Can we write a program to get a yes or no answer to a yes or no question?
By definitions, that is what computers do, yes or no.
Well,
it's their binaries.
Technically, it's on or off.
Yes, it's a binary. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a humanity.
So zero is off,
right.
One is on.
Right.
I would settle for getting a yes or no answer. I would settle for someone saying zero. Okay, I can deal with that.
The problem is that humans don't, humans would look at the result the computer gave them and interpret it.
How the hell do you interpret zero?
Humanity.
You know, every computer error at the end of the day is a human error, because if the computer makes a mistake, it was either a mistake in the code or a mistake in the input or a mistake in the interpretation. Technically, there is no such thing as a computer error, because computers only do what you tell them. They're stupid. 713-526-5738. One of the things that's been bugging me on and off for the last few months, we were talking about conservative memes. Do you remember the term corporate raiders? Now, the more dignified term is corporate activist. They are no longer so Carl Icahn, the guy who is the vulture capitalist who basically rapes companies by driving up their price. This is actually, it's the corporate raiders that began getting companies more focused on share price versus company value. So now you've got Carl Icahn, basically him and his ilk, I'm going to use that word, Carl Icahn and his ilk essentially force, their goal is to force up share prices because that's what they own. They own shares. They want the value to go up. They want to maybe get dividends or they want to get one-time payouts. They want to, if a company has a large cash reserve, instead of saving that for a rainy day or using it for research and development or acquiring companies that might synergistically improve the general value of the company, no. Now, because these guys are really corporate raiders and not corporate, what do they call them? Corporate activists. All they want to do is basically rape the company. So anytime you see corporate activist in the news, just in your head, change that to corporate raider. Okay? Another thing that that I've been watching, I don't know if you guys have heard about this. You know, China has what's called the nine-dash-line policy. It's called that because on maps, you have nine dashes in a row, and then a little bit more space, and then a nine dash in a row. And they use that to show their territorial claims. So it's not like this is their internationally recognized border or their internationally recognized maritime limit, what they call the maritime resources exploitation zone, or something to that effect. So China, over the last few years, as they've been getting richer, as they've been getting more powerful, as they've become militarily more threatening, having higher military potential, they have been pushing out into areas that are actually disputed by Taiwan, which of course they consider not a country but a renegade province, the Philippines, South Vietnam, Indonesia. Many countries have claims, and I haven't dug into it deeply, but if you look at the reasons for the various disputes from the various countries, they all have a certain amount of legitimacy. So it's not like there's a cut and dried claim, like China has an ironclad claim and Vietnam is just being a nuisance, or Taiwan has an ironclad claim and the Philippines is just being a nuisance. They're really... There are a lot of complicating things here having to do with unequal treaties and treaties made by illegitimate so-called governments. Very complicated. The Chinese have been trying to create what are sometimes called facts on the ground, or in this case, facts on the water. So they're taking things, for example, that are not considered islands, that are not permanently above the water, but they've been dredging sand, turning them into things like potentially airfields and military barrack areas to basically put troops and installations on these reefs, formerly reefs, just rocks that were never really above the water, in order to enhance, if not their claim to these territories, then at least... their ability to defend their claims, because they don't have aircraft carriers, so they actually have to move bases out. It's really interesting, you know, this overall Chinese territorial aggressiveness, increasing their air defense zones, increasing, they're now going to start upgrading some of their intercontinental ballistic missiles and MIRVing them. MIRV stands for Multiple Independent Reentry Vehicles. The United States pioneered the technology in the 1960s, so the Chinese now, instead of having one warhead per missile, they're going to upgrade their missile so they can carry three warheads, which is actually a very big technological step. So this is all stuff that, you know, maybe sort of below your radar screens in terms of the news you're reading or the stories you're seeing, but this is real stuff. Okay, I'm going to do a quick station ID and then get to Wayne. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and Egberto Willis on KPFT 90.1 FM. Houston, open forum. You can talk about anything I've brought up or any topic that's been on your mind. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Okay, that out of the way, Wayne. You're on the air. How you doing tonight?
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm good, thank you. So what's on your mind tonight?
Well, I just wanted to bring up the that there's a couple of things.
Okay.
That tomorrow, the DACA program would have went into effect. I've listened, you know, and hear around the city about people talking about the president not doing anything for black people and people of brown color and things like that there. But if the judge hadn't have stopped the DACA program, it would have went into effect tomorrow. Tomorrow is Malcolm X's birthday.
I'm sorry. Tell me what the DACA program is again.
It's about the implementation of the students, you know, for the...
like a DREAM Act thing?
Yeah, the DREAM Act.
Okay.
DACA, yeah. But tomorrow would have been Malcolm X's birthday. And if I remember correctly, Malcolm X was a brown man. He may have been a black man, but he was also a brown man.
Yeah, he wasn't a white man. We can agree on that.
Okay, let's agree on that. But the other thing that I want to talk about is the fact that I was watching the news today, and they had Lindsey Graham on there. Lindsey Graham, South Carolina senator. And I think it was a couple of questions asked to him, but the thing that nobody failed to ask him was that when Saddam Hussein was in Iran, and they's talking about how the war was this here and that, and nobody wants to blame Bush for it. But Bush was adamant about killing Saddam Hussein. He was very adamant about that. And that
it was like taking care of his father's unfinished business.
Yeah, and that has caused all kind of rift in the Far East countries over there. But that was the only man, in my opinion, that kept peace. And even with all the problems they had over there, he was the only man that kept peace. Now, they say he gassed his people, and if he did, he did it. If he did that, he was wrong.
He was a monster.
Yeah, well, as far as that goes, we could say Bush was a monster because...
Well, we can say Bush was a war criminal. I'm not sure he was a monster.
Okay, well, you use your tone, I'll use mine.
Okay. Hey, that's what makes a discussion, man.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that as long as Saddam Hussein was in rule over there, it kind of kept some kind of peace over there in that country. Now they have no rule over there. What is his name? Bashar
Assad. Assad. Bashar Assad. That's in Syria. Well,
yeah.
Here's a question, and it goes directly to what you're saying, and I think it's a question that a lot of people who think about foreign policy are now having to ask themselves, and it's a really hard question. Is the Middle East and areas like that, even though the West is very much about liberal democracy, sorry, Republicans, liberal democracy is the term, is an area, a region like the Middle East, North Africa, are they better off with their autocrats? In other words, as brutal as they are, as anti-democratic as they are, the kleptocracies that they run, but in spite of all the injustice they do, is that a lesser evil than the chaos that seems to envelop the region when you don't have autocrats, and which will probably simply end up at the end of the day with maybe some border changes with new autocrats?
No, because there's some that's not interested in that, Mike.
Interested in, I'm sorry, which?
I would say Bashar al-Assad, for one. He's not interested in that.
Not interested in democracy or autocracy?
Autocracy. Well,
he is an autocrat.
Explain to me. No, hold on.
Okay.
Hold on. I would say democracy. I would say democracy because Bashar al-Assad is all about building up his pockets and things like that.
Right.
He's not about for the people because he's had a chance to do that.
Right.
He's had plenty of chances to do that, and the country is steady going down. The other one over there in Nigeria, is it Nigeria? Where Boko Haram is now.
You're talking about Good Luck Jonathan, who was just voted out of office, maybe?
Yeah, but was Good Luck Jonathan really a bad president? I don't I don't know, but I know he didn't do anything to help find those little girls. I know that.
That, yeah. I mean, I didn't do a lot of reading on Nigeria. I did follow a little bit of Twitter feed on that at one point, and there was some debate as to whether he was good for the economy, but apparently was not so good for internal security, which at this point in Nigeria is, I think, the central issue.
Yeah. And well, you know, you get people in power, Mike, and they just basically about stuffing their own pockets. They're not about doing the right thing for their countries. And you know, they'll give you that. They'll give you that sweet talk and say those things that people want to hear. But when it's all actually said and done, and when it goes behind closed doors, that's not what actually happens.
But you know? And I'm going to just ask you this one last question, let you answer and let you go then, because I got a couple of other callers. But the question is, I'm not going to use the term autocrat again. I'm going to use a simple term, dictator. As a region, and for the majority of people, are these countries better off with dictators who maintain some kind of peace? Or are they better off with the mess they have now, where thousands and thousands of people are being killed as the different sides vie for power with bullets?
And in one instance, I would say that the one country that held the peace, pretty much kind of kept it down, was Iran. And that dictator was Saddam Hussein.
Iraq, you mean?
Iraq. And that dictator was Saddam Hussein. Now, maybe in that country, because I think he was more loyal than we know to the United States, I think that maybe there. But in those other countries, Bashar al-Assad, no dictators in those countries.
Well, Assad, I think, needed to leave. I think if he had simply left and taken some of his booty with him, booty not meaning, you know, girls, but booty meaning some of his ill-gotten gains, he could have lived out a very...
He took some of them with him.
Yeah, he could have had a very nice life, and his country might have had some kind of a peaceful transition of power. And now what you've got is a multi-year civil war with millions of people uprooted as refugees, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Wayne, I'm going to let you go now. I appreciate your calling. I hope to hear from you again.
All right, Mike. Have a good one.
You too. Take care. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM with Mike Honig and Egberto Willis. The call-in number is 713-526-5738. It is open forum, so you can talk about anything we've been talking about or anything that's been on your mind. Mike is the next one up. Mike, you're on the air. So Mike and Mike, you know what you have when you have
yes.
A mic on your right and a mic on your left?
What you got?
Stereo.
Ha, hilarious.
So okay. How you doing tonight?
I was wondering, recently I've heard news of a report that concludes that wealth disparity between that divided along racial lines can be traced back to federal housing policies, which forced discrimination and forced white people to stay live with white people and black people to live with black people. Segregation.
Redlining.
I've heard about this on NPR for the whole past week. And with Baltimore and Ferguson, et cetera.
I heard something about it. I haven't read the details, which is on
well,
me.
Well, so it, the gist of it is the 30-second breakdown is that whites were permitted to buy at the time when the Fair Housing Act was passed. The whites were allowed to purchase, or no, I'm sorry, prior to that. Whites were allowed to purchase basically in the suburbs, newer homes, whereas blacks were had to purchase within the city.
Yeah, basically
and
it was loan
so
discrimination.
They would aggregate wealth in the suburbs from the value of their home, and they actually quantified it as $400,000 more in Baltimore compared to its suburbs in terms of home value. And they started out economically similar. However, as two or three generations go by, the amount of equity built into their home allows them to put the kids through college, et cetera, et cetera. Everything that $400,000 over, 50, 60 years can do.
Yeah, essentially, families accumulate wealth generation to generation. As long as you don't have a generation that just blows it, the only way that families get rich typically is by accumulating it from generation to generation.
Right. Well, and then, I mean, we could get into the whole topic of the justice involved in passing down massive wealth from one generation to another.
That's a separate question.
What I would like to know or to discuss is what is it going to take for us to, as a society, to retake up, or to take up, I guess, seriously for the first time, the case for reparations? Because this hasn't started in the 50s, this didn't start in the 40s or the 20s or the 10s. This started back in the 1600s and 1700s. And, you know, even though the case of state rights versus federal power sort of was settled very, very clearly by General Grant, there still seemed to be there was a problem with making Reconstruction stick. And Reconstruction for 15 years was nowhere near long enough to make the sort of impact necessary to undo 200 years of slavery. So what is it going to take for us to discuss the making right the wrongs that have happened in the past in a real and true sense? Because it is my contention that that is the only way we are going to heal many of the ills of this that our society and our country face.
Well, I would say this. When you talk about reparations, that starts to get very tricky, because I think every country has oppressed somebody somewhere along the line. And, you know, it's kind of like the border question. It's like, well, this country owned this land for 30 years, but that country owned the land for 100 years before that, and some other country owned some portion of that land for two centuries before that.
But we're talking about people, not land.
No, well, it becomes, in a sense, a similar question. You're talking reparations, in a sense. I would make this potential argument. Affirmative action is a form of reparations. And it actually took me until I was much older to understand the basic premise of affirmative action, or what the basic premise should be, whether or not that was the original reason for it. And it is this. Assuming somebody doesn't have conscious racial bias, and they're interviewing two people for a job, both people are equally qualified, both people are equally personable, cultural differences minimal, and you've got a white guy and he's interviewing a black guy and a white guy. All things being equal, the natural tendency of people is to hire somebody they feel comfortable with. Now, is that racism? I suppose in a sense it is. But the reason for affirmative action is that you need to have a diverse representation of people in positions of power and hiring, so that when that very human question comes up, there are places where the preference will be a black person or a Hispanic person or an Asian person, because that's the comfort level. If all you have is white people hiring, there's always going to be a white hiring bias. So affirmative action in that sense is a form of reparation.
Okay, but how does that compare to the codified and quantified accumulation of advantage and disadvantage that has been passed down, and which led us, you know, to ridiculous things like, I'm being stopped by the cops. So,
All right, first things first. Take care. Good luck. All right. Gerald, I guess, is up next because Gary dropped off. Gary, you can call back. 713-526-5738. We do have open lines. Gerald, you're on the air. How are you doing tonight?
I'm old and tired.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
Anyways, I heard people there earlier say that about our spreading democracy. Well, our government, unfortunately, has overthrown so many democratic countries and put despots in their place. And I can't understand why the Iranians are angry with us. We overthrew their elected person back in the 50s. And under Eisenhower and everyone else following, if you weren't with us, you were against us. So we said they were communists. You know, we got rid of Patrice Lumumba down in the Congo.
And Allende and Mossadegh. And, yeah, I mean, we – essentially, you know, democracies, and this goes to what you're saying, democracies are very, I'm not going to say complicated. I think hypocritical is a fairer word, but that's not the word I was looking for either. It'll do. The problem with democracies is that democracies really believe in democracy, but when they start talking international relations, what they like is stability and predictability. And dealing with other democracies is messy and complicated and unpredictable. Just look what the United States does with various space programs with other nations. We stop them, we defund them, we expand them, we change our minds. It's really annoying. So,
well, anyways, that was just the beginning of what I was going to say. We say there's, you know, a conspiracy, so therefore, you know, our military is going to build up. So then we're not defending our country, we're into militarism. Now, I'm sure there must be some good men in our military that realize we need to be defense. We can't be in every country. In almost every country in Central Asia now, we're in about 130 countries with our military. Meantime, the Chinese are going in for the infrastructure of Latin America. I don't know where the Monroe Doctrine went out the window, I guess. And, you know, they're in Africa doing the same thing.
They're expanding their influence.
Yeah, well,
either commercially or militarily.
We're doing all this trash militarily, and so we're spending money on planes and tanks. Every 10 years we need new stuff, and instead of building friends and making hospitals and having schools, we're building military. We're wasting our resources.
Yeah, I think
we're not building anything. Not building anything for us. The roads in Houston are falling apart, that's obvious.
I think that there's a real problem with the people in our government, and I'm not going to say just conservatives and Republicans because I think it's really more widespread than that, but there seems to be an inability to understand that military power grows out of economic power, not the other way around.
Right.
And as long as we keep wasting our resources on military without developing our infrastructure, developing our economy, bringing jobs back from overseas, as long as we're simply dissipating our economic power, military power ultimately will follow. And,
well,
and it's a connection.
That's what the Chinese are doing. Be they a dictatorship, they seem to have more their eye on the target than we do.
Yeah, well, you know, that's one of the advantages of having an authoritarian regime, which essentially they are, is that decision-making is much more unified, much more centralized.
I don't know. I know it scared the heck out of me when Bush went into Iraq, and if you said you were against it, they were almost, it was like, to be fearful, like maybe you might be put in jail, and then they pass that Patriot to scare everybody. That's such a joke.
Conservatives are very, very interesting. They believe very strongly in rule of law, except when it works against them. They believe very strongly in the Constitution, except when it works against them. One of the things that I've argued many times is the ACLU, which they see as a liberal organization, it's probably the most conservative organization in the country. If there is an organization that fights for the literal meaning of the Constitution, which conservatives say is one of their goals, it's the ACLU.
Well, the Constitution's in flux. Justice Taney, you know, says, well, you know, slavery was all right. So it's a moving document, and it's not something that's set in stone.
It's a living document, as they say. But the words are the words. You know, they're subject to reinterpretation over time, but the words are the words.
Anyways, I just think that unless we stop dumping all of our money into planes and everything, I guess we're going to be lost. We need to put it into science, education, schools. And people don't. We have a large percentage of America now. Go after them. Go get them. I mean, please.
And that's, I think, partly because we have only 1% of the population is actually involved with the military. We don't have anything like universal national service, where everybody has some skin in the game, and that makes it really, really easy to just say, "Oh, let's invade here. Let's invade there," because you don't see it. And I'll tell you something else. You know, this military exercise, it's going to be taking place throughout the Southwest. What is it called? Jade Helm?
No idea.
Is that what it's called, Egberto? Jade Helm, I think it's called?
Jade Helm 15.
Right. And you've got a lot of these very, very conservative people fearing that this is the federal government taking over Texas. Well, the first thing we would point out is the federal government already owns Texas. That was settled in 1865. But I think that part of the concern may, even on an unconscious level, grow out of the fact that their sons and their daughters are not necessarily in the Army, because we don't have universal national service. So they have this little tight organization that's all volunteer that maybe their fear is owes their allegiance to just their general, just their colonel, just their president, and therefore is possibly ready to run rampant over the United States. I think that that's a real conservative fear.
I think there's something wrong with our military higher-ups. I'm not worried about the privates and the sergeants. They go in there at 18, and then they all become Republicans because they're told what to do, and they don't know any better. But these
there are a lot of Democrats in the military, actually.
Well, okay, that be as it may, but I know, like, after World War II, we had our ambassador for a short time to the Soviet Union was George Kennan. All he said was containment. No, yep. So these military guys pressed it to say, no, we need huge military. He did not mean that. Did not mean that at all. I had a professor at University of Tennessee, Lauren Silverman, who died, but he taught at the Air Force Academy. He just couldn't. Man, it used to annoy him when John Foster Dulles and these people used to get out there and talk that stuff. And Eisenhower was part of all that too. Eisenhower was responsible for outdoing Suharto.
Suharto Sukarno.
And Mosaddegh and the other guy went in Guatemala. Eisenhower was not a good grandfatherly man.
Okay, Gerald, I'm going to let you go. I've got a couple of other callers.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
No, you're great. Just, you know, it's time to give somebody else a turn, and thank you very much for calling.
Well, thank you. Anyways, I get disoriented after a while.
We all do that, and you know what? On radio, it's easy to digress, but give us a call back. You're listening.
Your contribution, too.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Okay, so you're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Open lines 713-526-5738. Open forum. Max, you're up next. Thank you for your patience. How you doing tonight? You're on the air. Hello, Max.
Yes. My question was about the comments you made about the Syria and Assad. If he left, everything probably would be somewhat peaceful.
Maybe.
And some form of law or rule of law, whatever, would have governed.
Maybe.
I beg. Oh, that's good. That's it. That's it.
Yeah, that's the maybe. Now.
But, you know, what I'm looking at, I'm not a pro-Arab or pro-whatever, Syria, whatever, but my contention is that if you look at Egypt, look at Yemen, you can't. For example, a few other countries, Libya, every one of them have got problems in the past two or three years.
Yep.
So my question is actually a little bit deeper than that. I'm trying to figure out, and Iraq, of course, included in that equation. I believe there is actually some conspiracy. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, I assure you, that made these countries in the past few years how they are now. There's very, very convoluted plan and plot, and it did exactly serve the purpose of whatever that power, that's government, whoever that is. I let your listeners try to configure that and figure maybe they would come up with a solution.
Well, actually, you make a very interesting point, because conspiracy is often a dirty word. Because everyone figures, everything's a conspiracy. Not everything's a conspiracy. But what you're talking about is what you might call political or diplomatic maneuvering. You can call that a conspiracy, but I don't think that that's really an accurate term for it. I think that there are certainly countries that are served by the chaos. So if you have a country that's becoming pro-Western, I think that there's a lot of incentive by some parties to disrupt that government. So as long as stuff is in chaos, as long as stuff is in flux, other possibilities exist. So, for example, if Egypt was going to become a democracy, and I have to tell you, the day that Morsi was overthrown, I had no love for Morsi. I think he was a great threat to democracy, but I don't think that what replaced him has been an improvement. And I saw all kinds of problems down the road. But if you were Saudi Arabia, if you were United Arab Emirates, you might have felt that the Islamic Brotherhood being in power was something that you did not like. So there might have been some maneuvering by various Sunni powers to overthrow the Muslim Brotherhood, and that created the chaos. You have the Islamic State, people that are jihadists, various groups, and Yemen had a government transition, potentially could have worked out as a peaceful evolution, but you had political and religious interests in that region that did not want that to occur. So now you've got civil war, you've got the Houthis that are Iranian-backed, you've got the central government, which is Sunni-backed. And, you know, is this conspiracy? No. This is, as they said, this is the great game of the great powers all competing for influence. This has been going on throughout history. Unfortunately, people get killed. Chaos kills people. So I think in terms of your overall question, I think that it's not the Western powers that are necessarily causing the chaos. I think you have a number of nations and political movements and religious movements, and all of them are in conflict, jockeying for power, and that's what's causing the mess, which then goes back to the question of, are we better off with dictators in some of these areas, or do we just have to let history take its course so that the colonial artificial boundaries become changed into a way that is perhaps more stable? I don't know.
Okay. Well, yes, and let me try to see if we can somewhat narrow this down.
Okay.
Was a common threat Syria, Iraq, Egypt, they all were powerful, regardless of whether we elect a dictator that's governing them, regardless of the type of government that we may not care for, but every one of them there's a common threat, and every one of those countries do not have the power they used to have. They're chaotic. They're basically is it. And I can only think of one nation in Middle East that benefits from that.
Okay, name it.
Oh, come on, Mark. I know you're intelligent. You figure
it out. I'm not.
In my view, Israel is the only one who benefited from three adversary position, which is Egypt, Syria, common border with both, and Iraq. These three countries were very powerful and out of that, and plus the other two, three countries that are still chaotic and all that, Yemen and all that included. But it somehow served the purpose of Israel just beautifully, just seamlessly.
You see, I thought you were going to name Iran, which is why I wanted to ask you.
Oh, no, not a rule. I mean, you know.
You don't think Iran is...
In marginal sense, but
a marginal
Israel
sense?
Is now in the safest position that it has ever been in its past existence since 1948. Because there's no power in Lebanon, there's nobody in Syria, Iraq is gone, Egypt is about the same. They basically eliminated three or four different powers. Now, this is my theory. I have no documentation, I have no proof of that, but always they say, you know, look, history always we think is just happened by coincidence. Nothing happened by coincidence, particularly when it comes to Middle East.
I would say this. I would not dismiss Israel as a player in the chaos. It would be stupid to do so. But to say that all of this is a grand plot from Israel understates the complexity of the interaction of national interests that are in that region. I'm sure Israel is a player. But Iran has its interests, and Saudi Arabia has its interests, and...
Well, for example, when it comes to Iran, how would Iran would benefit from a chaos in Syria? They were a friend with Assad, and they're still supporting him. So they had no say in Syria as far as... They didn't want chaos there. They didn't want instability, at least not in Syria.
Not necessarily in Syria, but the chaos in Yemen suits them. The chaos in Iraq suits them because it gives them an opportunity for greater influence in displacing the United States.
Right.
They do have a religious as well as a political and regional agenda.
Okay, well, Iraq. Well, let's go back to Iraq. Iran was not the power that asked the U.S. to intervene in Iraq.
That's on us.
Yeah, no, that's of course that's on us. And how did we get there? Well, of course, there were powerful voices. And they said, oh, we got to go in Iraq. Had nothing to do with 9/11. We all know that.
But when the United States went into Iraq and destabilized it, that created an opportunity for Iran, which they have been trying to exploit with some success.
Correct. So we cannot say there's a grand plot that Iran would be a party to that, because it happened. It just happened. They somewhat benefited from the chaos in Iraq and became a regional power. That I understand, but the point I'm trying to make is three or four of these countries that are very powerful militarily, they're somewhat stable. Like the people say right now in Iraq, we didn't have freedom, but we had security.
Well,
now it's the other way around. You know, we don't have security.
To use a phrase that has been bandied about since the 1950s or 60s, he may have been an SOB, but he was our SOB.
Correct.
All right, I'm going to let you go. I got a couple of other folks on the line. Thank you very much, Max. I appreciate it. Okay, next up is, let me do a quick ID. We've got, this is Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm Mike Koenig. I've got Egberto Willis here, and you can always contribute to KPFT at kpft.org. Sean, thank you for being patient. You're on the air. How you doing tonight?
Evening. How are y'all doing?
Okay, thank you. What's up?
Oh, no, I'm just listening, and the gentleman before was, he had a very good opinion, mm-hmm. Outlook. So what do you think causes all the turmoil going on right now in the Middle East?
Well, what causes it? Let's divide that up into two questions. What unleashed it was that you had these powerful autocrats who had control of the military and the police and were fairly ruthless in maintaining their power, and they were governing countries that were artificially created post-World War I. So you've got all of that stuff in the background. I think, though, that what you're dealing with is a lot of different religious, ethnic, and political conflicts that essentially had simply been suppressed, that have been in that region for thousands of years. And, you know, they've changed over time as religions have evolved and ethnic identities have evolved. But essentially what you've got is a bunch of people that are intolerant of each other, and all the Sunnis want to get rid of the Shia. I'm not going to say that. You've got Sunnis that want to get rid of Shias, Shias that want to get rid of Sunnis. You've got Egyptians that want to throw out the Libyans, and the Libyans that aren't happy about the Sudanese. And you got all of these different conflicts going on. I mean, you know, you see the same thing happened in the Balkans. Europe thought it was above and beyond that kind of thing, and yet you essentially had tribal conflicts going on in what used to be Yugoslavia. That was a tribal conflict. You can call it ethnic to make it sound more advanced and civilized, but it was all tribal. It was stuff going back to the Ottoman Empire 1,000 years ago when they had territory in southeastern Europe, and that war was still going on 1,000 years later. So when you say, what's the root of it? You know, it's like bad traffic. It seems like a truism to say it, but basically it's people. It's just people. People are the problem.
So you think, or you're saying that was the case during the Ottoman Empire, that there was, Turks, and they create this kind of clash of civilizations that we're witnessing right now, that you have now created separation of Turks and Muslims before that wasn't the case, but during and at the end of the Ottoman Empire, and that was sealed, you're right, in 1924, the Chaspee-Core Agreement, dividing of the kingdoms there.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about the breakup of the empire after the First World War, but there are actual treaties that were
involved. They didn't have that problem at that time, but.
Well, they suppressed
it. You know about Wahhabis, right? You know about Wahhabism. You know about the Sufi order.
The Wahhabis are mostly Saudis, right?
Yeah, and those are your ones that are getting paid right now to do all of the. But that wasn't a problem during the Ottoman Empire.
Well, you know, you talk about the Ottoman Empire, and they weren't the only empire involved. You know, the 15th...
Well, they were a very powerful empire.
They were a very powerful empire, but they were preceded by an Islamic empire. And actually, you had the spread of Islam throughout North Africa and the Middle East, but that wasn't the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire ended up being an outgrowth of that. It was... You had people in what is now Turkey who basically overthrew the Byzantine Empire and essentially took it over and made that into their own empire and then expanded it beyond that. But you also had people that were not Ottomans who actually controlled most of the Iberian Peninsula. And
that was all. And we talk about these different tribes and, you know, main players and that last gentleman's point. And he's talking about the, you know, the greater, I'm not going to say the same, but anyway, that was homogenous. They didn't have radical. There was no such thing as radical jihad. It meant the opposite, actually.
Well, they had jihad, but, you know.
Jihad was not violent. Jihad was prayer and power.
No, jihad was war.
Nothing by it means such.
Jihad is religious war. That's what the word means. Jihad is religiously based war.
Islam or jihad during the Ottoman Empire. The clash of civilizations that's being engineered right now that you're witnessing is what one say would be democracy, but that's just instilling separation. Gaddafi took the worst case of infant mortality and quality of life to the highest level of health, housing, education. He tapped into the water aquifer in the northern horn of Africa.
He was a great leader, except if you were not on his side.
Well, again, he had free education. He didn't have unrest. I'm not defending these people. I'm
right. It's complicated.
When you have depleted uranium, polluting, you know, over a quarter of the babies born are monsters, and, you know, in Iraq, and there's nothing but death right now going on. And you're right. You got like a million plus Americans that have been in war for 15 years, and everyone else is completely oblivious. It really works. I'm not going to get started, but I'll just state that these people we put in power, and when, you know, like a mafia, I don't think they have much, you know, standards, but, you know, and yeah, Gaddafi got out of line in the 80s, and Reagan blew up his town and killed his son, and he got back, and then Sarkozy came back and befriended him and took him down.
Quite a mess, isn't it, when you look at it?
Rang on the last day of Ramadan, and the NATO forces, the amphibious ships came on shore and they mowed down. It's easy to make comments and opinions. We all have our opinions. We're entitled to them. But I think ignorance is bliss, and we can basically not really know what's going on. We're far from even talking about what's actually going on, and it's not my place to force my opinion on you.
Well, Sean, I appreciate your calling and raising the questions. I have another caller I want to get to before the end of the show. Call again.
Ciao.
All right. Take care. All right. Jerry, thank you for your patience. You're on the air. I just want to say one thing before we move forward. We are now living in a politically multipolar world. And what we are seeing in the grand historical scheme is a period between empires. So you had the 19th century, when you had a few empires and you had some wars around the edges, and then you had a bipolar world, the Western democracies led by the United States and the Eastern bloc led by the Soviet Union. And as long as you had a bipolar world like that, you had, again, conflict at the edges, but the world was a little bit more stable. Now we have this it started out as a unipolar world, but then you have a couple of rising powers and you have this chaos, which is sort of a between imperial powers period. That's anyhow how I see it in sort of a poorly phrased way, perhaps. So, Jerry, you're on the air. Tell me what's on your mind tonight. Thanks for coming.
I just wanted to say that, you know, right now Israel's problem is exactly the opposite of what that guy said. It's not states as such that are going after Israel and all that. It's different subdivisions in states and everything. In other words, it's the balkanization that's going on over there in the Middle East. It's actually more dangerous to Israel and more unstable for Israel than, you know, whenever they have a conflict with Lebanon, they don't have a conflict with everybody in Lebanon.
Right.
And it's worth noting that, you know, there's groups over there that they don't bother with, worry about, and don't bother them. You know, don't attack them or anything like that.
There's a group. Go ahead. It's all right.
There's a group that does and everything. They bomb Israel and do this, that, and the other. And, you know, of course, Israel bombs them back and all that. And that's also true for what's happening in Palestine right now. There's two different competing factions in Palestine.
At least.
And everything. And, you know, basically one of those factions is pretty much more or less in control of the foreign policy and stuff like that. And,
you're talking about Hamas.
Yeah. So, you know, if you want to, you know, the instability is a worse problem for them. They haven't gone up. There hasn't been a state versus state war in what? How many decades? You know, since the 70s.
Yeah, you could make that argument.
And everything. So, you know, since basically the last time they went up against Egypt or whatever and all that, they've gotten along relatively well with those guys.
The Yom Kippur War in 73. Since then, it's been like Hamas, it's been Hezbollah, it's been...
And all those other little factions, and now you see that throughout
actors.
The Middle East and actually a good chunk of North Africa and all that. And it's actually that Balkanization, there's an old word, it's that Balkanization of those groups that, you know, it's basically those people dividing out. That goes back to your thing about the Ottoman Empire. It's the Balkanization of those groups. What happened was is we basically ripped the mask off of what's going on in the Middle East.
Right.
We made that second invasion of Iraq, and we took over the country. As, you know, basically we took physical control of the country more or less in like a matter of weeks.
But we did it badly.
We did it badly, but we did show we could wreck any of those societies that we wanted to. You know, basically, we can come over and destroy your country. We can't put it back together.
Yeah, there's that.
But we can destroy your country, and we can do it relatively cheap and easy.
I want to talk
and
a little.
Very few, you know, very few casualties to ourselves or whatever, and everything. You know, there was a. You know, basically, what those dictatorships said was we protect you from the crazy Americans and the perfidious Israelis.
Right.
Well, that was wrong. That was not true and everything. And what that war showed, what this last go-around showed, was that that was the case.
Okay, I'm going to have to just stop you here because we're almost out of time. I want to make one point, though, that I think touches on what you're saying. To the extent that Israel participates in this fragmentation and this non-state actor stuff going on, I think it's the constant conflict in diplomatic perspective of the long-term need versus the short-term need. Because sometimes the short-term need of creating the chaos is very attractive, but sometimes what you end up with is much worse than what you had. So, all right, well, could have used another hour tonight, maybe. We got to go. Thanks so much for listening. Remember, if your vote didn't matter, they wouldn't try so hard to suppress it. Go to the county clerk and go to the state Secretary of State. See what primaries are coming up. Make sure you're registered to vote. Have a great week. I'll speak to you next week.
KPFT is seeking prospective volunteers to help in our music library. Our music library is a massive resource for our DJs and listeners. Volunteers will be assigned a number of different tasks, from refiling CDs to converting music for inclusion into the upgrade of our music library focused on digital. We're also looking for people who can spot up-and-coming bands to feature on our HD3 music stream. Successful volunteers will be team players who work well with others, have the ability to alphabetize, and can manage multiple tasks. Shifts happen weekdays, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. This is an unpaid volunteer gig, but it is one of the most fun times ever for anyone into music, music discovery, and turning others on to outstanding music. Interested? Drop an email to music@kpft.org with the subject line Music Volunteer. We'll take it from there. This is 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.